Hello, hello. Welcome to the Trinity Forum and Readings in the Forum, Love and Hope. I am Michelle Hoover, and I'm just going to introduce all these wonderful folks and then shut up and let them take it. So first we have Douglas Bauer. Oh, by the way, this panel is called Two Dougs and a Daphne. We weren't able to find a third Doug, and finding another Daphne is just impossible. Douglas MacArthur is dead, I'm afraid. And he probably wouldn't be a very good reader. Okay. Douglas Bauer is the author of three novels and three books of nonfiction, including The Stuff of Fiction, Advice on Craft, named the Public Library Foundation of Iowa's Outstanding Writer in 2003, which I think is cool because I'm an Iowan. He has won grants from the National Endowment for the Arts in both fiction and nonfiction. Of his most recent book, What Happens Next, Matters of Life and Death, writer André Debus III writes, "These are some of the finest, if not the finest, personal essays I have ever read. With exacting and exquisite prose, Douglas Bauer achieves the truly remarkable here. He plumbs the heart of his Midwestern family with brave and naked fairness, rendering his own mortality with a steadfastly clear-eyed and life-loving attention. The book is masterful, soul-nourishing work." Daphne Calatay's Calamity and Other Stories was shortlisted for the 2005 Story Prize, and her debut novel, Russian Winter, has been published in 21 foreign editions. Her most recent novel, Sight Reading, received a star review from Booklist, who called the novel a fictive, musical, and familial feast. And the Toronto Star writes that Calatay infuses each of her characters with total believability, stemming from her understanding of classical music and her perceptions of human nature. She's a very wise writer. That's such a cool thing to be called. And her brilliant intuitions are augmented by her lyrical writing. She knows music and understands musicians, and that makes sight reading a gift. And finally, Douglas Trevor is the author of two books of fiction, including the short story collection The Thin Tear in the Fabric of Space, which won the 2005 Iowa Short Fiction Prize and was a finalist for the 2006 Hemingway Foundation Pen Award for First Fiction. Of his most recent book, the novel Girls I Know, published by 617 Press, Peter Ho Davies writes, "By turns funny, flirtatious, and fierce, Girls I Know is above all a work of real heart. I can't recall when I last felt so in love with a novel's characters. But if I had to compare Douglas Trevor to anyone, he puts me in mind of a young John Irving." And Kirkus Reviews calls the book an infecting novel of love, coming of age, and theistic ontology. As much a love song sung to Boston as a conventional novel and a welcome debut. We're first going to have Douglas Bauer read, and then we'll be taking questions after each author reads. Doug.
Thanks to everyone for coming. What a great crowd. I'll just start sort of in the middle of an essay, and I think you'll get the idea of how it's thematically relevant, toward the end at least. Marvin Weiniger was, at 17, a tree trunk of a young man, with a big round face and a crew cut as flat as a just-trimmed hedge. His gait was a rhythmic side-to-side rocking, his legs bowed, his massive chest leading like a prow. He was a brute whose brutishness contained an amiable sweetness, his smile warm and benedictory when he passed you in the hall or walked with you from the locker room to football practice. When I was Marvin's high school teammate, I didn't see his tick-tock stride as the first sign of what was not quite yet a limp, the result of serial injuries to one of his knees. Instead, I saw it as the way you got to walk if your nickname was Hoss, as Marvin's was, a nickname you had earned, as Marvin had, because of the violent joy with which you knocked people down on a football field, as Marvin did. As a boy, I was an especially vivid fantasist. And as this story will show, I carried the tendency into adolescence and much beyond. For me, Haas was mesmerizing evidence that bearing an injury, or even better, playing with it, playing through it, defined the kind of lonely valor, a greater grit, a more textured courage. An indelible moment on an autumn Friday night, the field lights silvering the frost-crusted grass, Beyond the end zones and the goalposts, harvested cornfields disappearing into the Iowa night. The few sections of bleachers on either side of the field were sparsely filled, since those who really cared, a third, sometimes as much as half of the crowd, stood close to the sidelines behind a field-long length of snow fence and moved back and forth with the action to keep the play in front of them. I was standing, too, at our bench with the other reserves when I spotted Haas hop-skipping off the field and pointing to his fragile knee. Seeing him, our coach ordered a substitute into the game as he hurried out to meet Haas and help him to the bench. Coach McAllister was a small man, short, very short, but thick-necked and muscular. His first name was Jerry. Behind his back, we called him Jerry Babe, not out of disrespect, but with amused affection. To us, he was an exotic figure. We'd somehow come to know that he was an ex-Marine, though it's hard to imagine how he met the height requirement. And his coaching voice was a bark that rose to an excited squeak when his team did something very right or very wrong. It was a voice you could easily imagine screaming at the newly enlisted. The other exotic thing about him was his right index finger, almost all of which was gone. No one would have dared ask him about it. By consensus, we attributed it to an act of battlefield heroism in Korea, his trigger finger blown off in the taking of Porkchop Hill. All to say that it was extremely cool to have a coach who was a tiny ex-Marine with an ugly stub of an index finger. Reaching the sidelines, Haas dropped to the ground and lay on his back while Jerry Babe knelt down, and together they hastily unbuckled the elaborate brace Haas wore. Jerry Babe had a few times blown his whistle to stop practice and tend to Haas after he'd hit someone and his knee slipped out of joint, but it hadn't happened in a game. Under the lights, in front of a crowd, which made those previous occasions dress rehearsals of a kind. They exchange ready, ready nods. Then Jerry Babe gave a practice pull and Haas's knee clicked back into place. Whole again, he hurriedly strapped back his brace on, jumped up and ran out to rejoin the play. Behind me, a cluster of local men laughed appreciatively. You see that? Bastard popped up like a jack-in-the-box. His goddamn guts. They had 10 more like him. 10. I'd do with 2 or 3. It says everything about what I wished to be and wasn't, that I saw Jerry Babe bending down to tend to Haas as something deeply fraternal, as the way wounded warriors acknowledged one another, the two of them speaking a private language of fluent nods, a wordless diction of goddamn guts. I wanted Haas's knee. Earlier that season, I'd been tangled up in a pile in a blocking drill when my left knee gave, then snapped back into alignment. What I felt inside an entirely new degree of pain was the quick abrasion of grinding parts. I got to my feet as Jerry Babe trotted over and asked me if I was all right. The knee had already begun to stiffen. I said I was. When my final season came and I was at the starting quarterback, I wore a supportive pad around the knee. I call it supportive, and I told myself it was, even as I knew it was only a standard-issue knee pad, a rectangle of foam rubber inside a wide band of red elastic fabric, nothing like the elaborate scaffolding that supported the now-graduated Haas's knee. In truth, I wore the pad, not because I believed my knee was more than slightly at risk. Dressing for practices and games, I made sure some of the red elastic pad showed below the leg of my white football pants because I wanted Jerry Babe to see it and be reminded that I'd hurt my knee and yet continued to play. I wanted those who came to our games and moved up and down the sidelines, watching for a bastard with some goddamn guts. I wanted them to see that band of red elastic and think that I was playing with a chronic injury. Most of all, I wanted Louise to see it from where she stood near the bleachers with the other cheerleaders in the scarlet and black outfits. We'd been dating for a year. She was a petite brunette with a wide, unavoidably flirtatious smile. To say that ours was nothing more than the usual adolescent ardor is, of course, to say that it was something febrile. And yet, night after night, we managed to stop at the last, and I mean last, moment, panting, sweating, with most of our clothes and on some ecstatic occasions, all of Louise's scattered on the floor around the couch. Our sense of right and wrong contested agonizingly with our urges, and in its way, it was as visceral. It was a moral weather we couldn't escape. Thanks for listening.
All right. So I'm going to read two excerpts from Sight Reading about love and hope, introducing two characters of the three in this book. So this first excerpt takes place in 1987 in Italy. There's a conductor and composer in this book who is married with a young daughter, but has managed to find himself having an affair with a woman who he's maybe fallen in love with. And to escape this affair, he quickly ends it, and great timing because he has to go abroad for this music festival. So we're going to meet him when he arrives there. This Saturday's lecture by visiting conductor Nicholas Elko has been canceled due to a death in the family. Our thoughts are with him in this time of sadness. Nicholas dropped his travel bag, felt his skin grow cold. The flyers were posted all around the little train station, and though they were written in Italian, he didn't need his years of study in order to translate. His love of opera meant he was used to words like death and sadness being hurled back and forth. His heart began a frenzied pounding. Who had died, and why hadn't he been informed? A wreath of sweat broke from his scalp. Jesse in an accident at camp? Hazel run over by a Boston driver? Awful possibilities raced before him. His sister at her military outpost attacked by a traumatized patient. His demented father lost in the Paps of Jura. Now he was fully sweating. He ran to the ticket window, where a man with a curling mustache smoked a cigarette as if the world were the same place it had always been. "That's me," Nicholas explained, his voice shaking as he pointed at one of the flyers and tried to discern the source of this news. Only hours later, when, from a clunky payphone at the post office, he had called all possible relatives across three continents and two islands and found everyone to be living, did Nicholas understand that there had been a mistake? An official at the music festival uncovered the mix-up. It was another composer, the one from Barcelona, whose relative had died. "Sorry for the confusion. Mi dispiace." Nicholas looked past the boxy telephone, out to the peaceful green hills, and accepted the apology. He retrieved his bag and suit jacket and made his way down the town's one road, past bobbing poppies and tall, scrappy weeds. Only as he approached the little hotel where the festival had booked him a room did it strike him as odd that the notices would have been posted at the station. Shouldn't they have been at the lecture hall? Typical Italian inefficiency. Well, it wasn't worth blaming anyone, he told himself, as he followed the innkeeper, a gray-haired woman with two pairs of glasses dangling around her neck, down the hallway to his room. The woman spoke in a rapid, rote way that Nicholas didn't quite follow, something about the outside door locking at 11, and handed Nicholas a metal ring with four small keys. With that, she left him. Nicholas removed his travel clothes, acrid with dried sweat, and lay naked on the thick, coarse sheets. Taking deep breaths, he listened to his heartbeats and tried not to think about the train station. He had nearly confessed to Hazel right there on the telephone, so relieved he was to hear her voice. But the awkward half-second delay would have made such a conversation even more painful. What mattered was that they had been spared. Everyone was all right. He had been swallowed by an abyss, tossed back up, and survived. When his pulse had finally slowed, he rose and bathed and dressed and went to dine with the festival's director, a man named Lothar, a German businessman who had lived in Italy for decades and fancied himself a musician. "You've grown up," Lothar announced as he dislodged a tiny grilled bird from a skewer. "There are lines at the sides of your face." "Yes, it's no longer a boy's face. Even you have been aged by life, then." The image that came to Nicholas was of her wrists and her curls and her wide brown eyes. His jaw had trembled when he'd explained to her that they had to end things. But Nicholas described to Lothar his move to Boston and his busy summer schedule. He slid from his wallet photos of Jesse and of Hazel and launched into a detailed description of his job at the conservatory and the various commissions that had been coming his way. Talking soothed his nerves. He drank more red wine than usual and found himself telling Lothar about the posters at the station. Lothar listened carefully, then said, "To me, it sounds suspiciously like a dream. You're sure you didn't dream it?" "More like a nightmare," Nicholas grumbled. Lothar nodded. "It has all the elements, doesn't it? A foreign location, panicked phone calls, a symbolic death. And most interestingly, that momentous question, now that you've lost someone important, perhaps the most important person in your life, who is that person?" Nicholas frowned. "Psychoanalytic rubbish." "I don't go in for dream analysis," he said. The afternoon scare was still very real, and nothing he was prepared to analyze. "Well," Lothar said briskly, "I'll see to it that by tomorrow the last of those flyers will have disappeared. You'll forget you ever saw them. And your lecture will be well attended, don't worry." Nicholas wasn't worried at all, though he hadn't yet prepared his lecture. He would do it tonight before he went to bed. But the thought of the flyers still troubled him somehow. So that's one of the three main characters in the love triangle in this book, which moves forward in leaps of 10 years twice. So I'm going to finish by reading a section from 10 years later, when I'm not giving too much away to say that marriage has ended. And we're going to meet now his wife, who has spent the past 9 or so years quite unhappily. She hasn't really adjusted to being divorced, and she's a single mother, and she doesn't have the best attitude, which is not helping her. And we're going to meet her now in 1997. Things are looking up for her. She has a nice potential beau who she's been on a couple of dates with, and his birthday's coming up, and after a lot of thought, she's decided to buy him some socks. So we're going to go with her to buy some socks. Heading toward the department store, Hazel couldn't help thinking how wonderful it would be if things worked out with Hugh, that she might be part of a couple again, not just a lone divorcee in a sea of couples, was a thought she barely allowed herself to indulge in. It wasn't so much living one's life alone that was awful. It was that her aloneness seemed like an element of her personality, as if her singledom were a character trait and not simply a situation beyond her control. Surrounding her all the time like a cloud of gnats was Hazel's awareness, everyone's awareness, she supposed, that there was something unseemly about being a divorced woman. Perhaps it was the mystery of what it was that was keeping an attractive woman all alone. Perhaps it was the unbecoming notion of a woman in her 40s still going out on dates like a teenager. Perhaps it was the cliche of the desperate divorcee, bitter and on the hunt. With a sigh, Hazel pushed through the front doors of Lord and Taylor, and there, just a few paces ahead of her, was Remy. That's the young woman from the affair that we've witnessed. Hazel could have caught up to her if she wanted to, could have said a friendly hello. Instead, she slowed her steps, let Remy continue into the women's section. This city really was too small. Hazel was already in the men's section anyway. There was no need to pretend to want to chat with Remy. Absently, she picked up a packet of boxer underwear, but she couldn't help it. She looked ahead to where Remy was and saw her fingering a big, ruby-colored maternity blouse. Hazel dropped the packet of underwear. She tried to retrieve it, but her fingers wouldn't quite work. Again, she looked over to make certain she was correct. Yes, there it was, the sign overhead, maternity. Now Remy was holding the blouse up against her front, admiring herself dreamily in the mirror. So it was possible after all these years. Hazel had assumed that was the one thing that would never work out for them. After all, it had taken long enough for Hazel herself to conceive. The doctors had said Nicholas had low sperm count, that his sperm were weak swimmers. Well, something like that was how she'd understood why it had taken 4 long years for him to finally fertilize one of her perfectly healthy eggs. "May I help you, ma'am?" The store clerk, very young, bent down to retrieve the packet of underwear. "Yes, I'm looking for a good pair of men's wool socks, the best you have." To Hazel's surprise, her hands were trembling. Ridiculous. Why should it matter to her if Remy were pregnant? Well, because her own daughter would now have a sibling. Hazel followed the young man toward the socks. These are our most elegant ones, he told her, displaying a pair of dark gray knee-highs. Merino wool, made in Italy. Ridiculous, they looked. A skinny, droopy, overpriced pair of socks. She rubbed the long toe between her fingertips. What if Hugh thought a pair of socks like this piddly? On the other hand, what if he thought them extravagant, too much money spent on something unnecessary? The key to this thing with Hugh, she knew, was not to appear too invested, not to need him too much. The toe is double knit, the man told her. It feels thin, Hazel said, concerned. Maybe this wasn't the perfect gift after all. If you'd like something thicker, we have these over here. The young man was turning toward a tree of socks atop one of the glass cabinets. Or, if you want something in between, we have these. He reached underneath into the glass cabinet, where an array of socks were layered one over the other in a fan. They come with a lifetime guarantee. When they wear out, you just send them in for a replacement pair. Hazel felt her brow furrowing, her heart racing, as the man handed her a pair to admire. Is there a problem? He asked. How could she explain? The problem was that only the perfect gift would do, because it was all so difficult and the chances so slim. Whatever she gave Hugh had to be just right, because if it wasn't and things didn't work out, she would blame herself for buying the wrong gift, for doing the wrong thing. I'm sorry, I need to think this through a bit more. It mattered now somehow so much more than she thought it mattered. Yes, of course, the young man said, take your time. But he took the pair of socks from her and put them back under the glass, as if to show her that she had missed her chance. Thanks.
I don't have the level of coordination to read from the stool, so I'm going to stand behind the podium. I'm sorry. I'm so impressed by the balance and grace of Doug and Daphne. So I'm going to read a late scene from my novel, Girls I Know, so I need to set it up just a little bit. I was looking for love and hope, and the pages were flipping by as I went through it. So my book follows several characters in and around Boston in the wake of a restaurant shooting set fictitiously in early 2001. So one of these characters that we'll meet in a second is a wealthy New Yorker, 20-year-old Ginger Newton, a Harvard undergrad with a pet snake, writing a book called Girls I Know, which is about what women do to get by in 21st century Boston. Another character is 29-year-old Walt Stedman, who's been trying for years to write a dissertation on Robert Lowell. So just prior to this scene, Ginger has sold her book for a small fortune, her book Girls I Know, and agreed to meet Walt for brunch. So I thought what I'd do is read the brunch scene and then a few sentences that follow when Walt returns to his dorm room and encounters his old friend and hallmate, Javier. So thank you for coming out. Although the Charles Hotel sat in the middle of Cambridge, Walt had never been inside of it before. He had never been inside any of the hotels in Cambridge or Boston since he had never had any out-of-town visitors. He passed through the low-ceiling lobby and up the stairs to the main restaurant, Henrietta's Table, where brunch was served each day. Ginger was waiting for him at a table in front of the enormous windows that looked out onto the restaurant's patio, but she wasn't looking out the windows. She had opted to face the interior, where the people were. Hey, Walt. Hi, Ginger. She rose from her chair and circled the table. She had cut her hair in an oval to frame her face, the ends lingering just above her shoulders. She was wearing a camel-colored suede skirt and a black sweater. When they embraced, Walt could smell her shampoo and body wash. He could feel her right leg square up against his left thigh and the smooth skin on the back of her neck where he had placed his hand. You smell like mold and sweat, she whispered, like some nasty old graduate dormitory. You don't smell at all like your snake, Walt replied, his eyes closed. Oh, poor Sid, Ginger said. He's been neglected for so long now. I'm not the mother I once thought I was. She pulled back from him. He lifted his hands off her body. He let her go. They sat down. Congratulations again, he said, on Girls I Know, that contract. That's amazing. It is, isn't it? But she didn't sound very amazed. Yeah, it's cool. She eyed the table. She didn't want to talk about her book deal, that was clear. It would be her curse, Walt decided, not to need any money and therefore to have it thrown her way again and again throughout her life. A busboy circled by with a pot of coffee. He filled Walt's cup. Ginger had been sitting there for a little bit. Walt could see her black leather journal filled with scribbles and a half-empty glass of orange juice. Is your editor asking you to change much in the book? She wants me to add some stuff. You know, interview New York girls, New Jersey girls, make it more of an Eastern Seaboard thing. My editor thinks the category of the male is no longer interesting. She thinks we're done with it as a culture. She's all about the idea of girls. So naturally, now I have my doubts. Well, I had them before, but I have more doubts now. Walt took a sip of coffee, which was nutty and piping hot and incredibly smooth. A woman set a basket of bread on their table, wheat, rye, raisin. Heat billowed out of the basket, all the smells mixed together. Walt took a piece of rye. He sipped his coffee until he had finished it. As soon as he placed the empty cup on its saucer, the busboy glided back over and poured him another one. Okay, enough about me, Ginger said. Have you made any progress on your dissertation? Actually, I've decided I don't want to be an academic. What do you mean? Walt felt nervous. I love poems. I've always loved poems, but I don't want to write about poems. I just want to read them. Maybe give the ones I like to other people to read. That's the kind of relationship I want to have with poetry. I don't want to be a critic. So I just signed up for the teacher residency program at UMass Boston. Classes start this summer. In the fall, I'll be working with a mentor. Then I'll get my own students that following year. There's a salary. It isn't much, but it's something. Wait a second. You're going to teach elementary school? I'm going to try. In the Boston public school system? That's the idea. Ginger strummed the table with her fingers. Walt had fully expected her resistance to the idea of him becoming a teacher. It would never seem ambitious enough for someone like her. It would always sound too limiting, too small. Ginger shifted uncomfortably in her chair. Teachers get so ground down, Walt. You can pick them out on the street. They wear those polyester blends. They're all pasty. They have a dazed look in their eyes from grading. I hate to think of you looking dazed. They both sat still. I'm doing it again, Ginger shook her head. I don't know what I'm talking about, but I think I do. You know, ever since we met, you've listened to me way too closely. You've given me much more credit than I ever deserved. The truth is, I have no right to weigh in on your decision. I've never even been in a public school. Walt opened and then shut his menu. You know, Ginger, my grandparents were both teachers, he said. They were real teachers. They knew what they were doing. They had the steadiness of good teachers. They were dogged. They made you listen to them without raising their voices. They let you know what they were talking about was important without having to try to convince you. And it's not necessarily that I want to be that kind of teacher, but it's work that speaks to me. I get the stakes. She nodded. When you put it that way, I see what you mean. So that means we're both dropping out of Harvard. You for the second time. What a pair of losers we ended up being. She lifted her water glass and they toasted their shared status as losers. Then, still staring into her eyes, Walt reached for her hand across the table. Hey, listen, don't move back to New York. Live with me. I'm going to rent a truly awful apartment somewhere. Rent it with me. We'll go 50-50. A truly awful apartment. That's tempting. You'll learn to economize. It'll be fun for you. I'm sure it would be. You'll finish up this book and the churning in your brain will die down some. I'll educate the young while you buy frozen rats for Sid. On the weekends, we'll go to your family's nearest vacation home. That'd be in Mattapoisett, but I'm warning you, it's a real dump. And I'll teach you all about jazz. We'll listen to each of my records, one after the other. We won't play any of them more than once until we've listened to them all. Ginger let his hand go. She ran her fingers through her hair. All of that sounds really lovely, Walt, she said. The shitty apartment, the records. But I'm sorry, I have to go back to New York. I can't stay in Boston. I have to move on. You need someone to be around you, Walt said, trying his hardest not to sound as if he were pleading. We all do. It's not a sign of weakness. It's a trait of our species. You sound like my mother, Walt, Ginger said. Their server came by. She ordered the fruit plate. Walt chose a cheese omelet with toast and hash browns. He chose something bland on purpose because he had a feeling he wouldn't be coming back to the Charles Hotel anytime soon, and he didn't want to have to remember a great meal along with everything else. I didn't say you needed someone to take care of you, Walt explained. after they were alone again. You should just have someone lingering around. And I have experience on that front. From my days as a superintendent, I'm a really good lingerer. She laughed loudly at that. Oh, shit, Walt. Believe me, if there was one person I'd choose for that thankless duty, it'd be you. But honestly, it would be really thankless duty. You'd hate me after 1 month, or you'd go barking mad. Well, let me worry about that. She looked down at the table. It's just, there are so many things I want to do, and you know, I'm not the best at pacing myself, which I think means I wouldn't make a very good girlfriend. Not that I'm really comfortable with that term anyway. But you don't have to explain. Walt felt tremendous sadness, though. He liked the idea of making his way through life with her. He didn't care anymore that her family had money. The fundamental unfairness of life still pained him, but not in such a way that prompted him to point his finger at Ginger. That had been, he thought in hindsight now, more a strategy to unburden himself from any responsibility to remake the world that surrounded him than an expression of moral outrage. "Do you want to hear about my next book?" she asked him. "I think it's going to be about birds, about how they migrate. I need to be done with humans for a while. And birds are so interesting. Did you know that bar-tailed godwit can fly 6,000 miles without stopping? 6,000 miles. And some birds can sleep and flight. Winchets leave Europe in the fall to winter in the tropics." And she went on. Their waitress brought out their food. In between Ginger's observations on avian navigation and the energy conserved by Canada geese flying in V formations rather than by themselves, Ginger ate quickly. And suddenly the scene that Walt had conjured and mulled over in anticipation began to slip away. They finished eating, Ginger paid the bill, and they walked out of the restaurant, descended the carpeted steps, and passed through the lobby onto the brick courtyard that wrapped around the front of the hotel. Now awash in sunlight, Ginger waved at a taxi idling 30 yards from them. When it pulled up, Walt opened the door for her. She stepped in and rolled down her window. "I think you'll make a great elementary school teacher." "Do you think so?" "I do. You'll look good standing in front of a chalkboard." "And I won't have the guts to give anyone a bad grade." "Exactly. You'll be the ultimate pushover. They'll love you." She smiled at him, her eyes squinting in the sun. He stepped back from the car. "Just call if you ever want to talk," she hollered. "No biggie." The taxi lurched into traffic as Ginger waved out the window. "I'm going to miss you." He watched the cab tear down Elliott Street, then turn onto JFK and disappear. And he couldn't help but he really wondered if he'd ever see her again. Javier was sitting in the hallway reading while he waited for Walt to return. "What'd she say?" he asked when Walt appeared. Walt opened the door to his dorm room and threw his parka inside. "She said she has to move on. Her next book is going to be about birds. She said she cares about me, but she has to move on. She said no to being with you because she's going to write a book about birds." "Basically, she chose birds over you? If you want to look at it that way." Javier stood up. "I'm so sorry, man," he mumbled. "No, it's okay," Walt said. "It could be much worse." And he thought it over a little bit more. "All things considered, it could be much worse. Thanks."
All right. Now we'll take questions from the audience. Yeah. So the question was about dialogue. How do you polish your ear in writing dialogue?
Well, I just read aloud all the time. I mean, and particularly in the revision process. And sometimes when I'm doing an early draft, I might be writing in a cafe or something. But I feel like I have to hear the voices, and it's really fun for me to have the characters talking back and forth. So I think the auditory realm is the essential realm for dialogue.
Trains and
well, I have the luxury of teaching since I teach at the University of Michigan, so I have these young people who have this cadence and these words, these phrases that just kill me. My young kids are, I mean, my son William, who's 10, asked if I do a solid for him the other day because he didn't want to do his homework. So I just think those phrases. So I'm a sponge for that stuff. I love that stuff. But especially, I think. I mean, I feel like I have a sense of how my friends and people my age talk. It's people who are older than and younger than me that I really like to listen to.
Okay, another question?
Is it easier to write a woman's voice or a man's voice, or does it make any difference?
Is it easier to write in a women's voice or a man's voice in terms of dialogue?
The dialogue, yeah.
Okay.
Well, I enjoy writing from a female perspective more in some ways than writing from a male perspective. I find it more interesting, but I also makes me nervous too. I think that for me, the character is what creates. I don't know if I would call it ease, but that creates a level of familiarity or excitement for me. And so I don't think about the gender distinctions as much when I'm working on characters. And I would love to hear what the other writers think on that subject.
The other Doug?
My first novel was from the woman's point of view. And so, you know, the dialogue, I think, sort of percolated up out of the sensibility that I imagined the woman had. And I imagined her talking in the way that she felt and thought. So I think, for me, it kind of works that way. You establish the interior of the character, male or female, and then, you know, the way in which they talk sort of is a reflection, I think, of that. The other thing I found about writing from a woman's point of view is there's a whole lot more things that the genders share than that they are in opposition, I think. So I didn't get too hung up on the idea that I'm writing a woman, I can't do this, I can't do that. I was thinking about the person.
Definitely.
Likewise, in my short stories, I had male protagonists, and I was very much in their heads and in their voices, but I was really thinking more about what age is this person, what background, what education. You know, that said, I do think, I notice, if you listen, there are certain phrases that women use that men don't use. And so often after I've written the scene, I'll go and make sure I don't have those. And, you know, it's funny, I used to belong to a woman's gym, and I would notice when they had signs about things, you know, like if one of the bathroom stalls wasn't working, it would say, "We are so sorry." And I, you know, that's something I remember thinking, wow, we do that. And men don't say that. They would say, "We're sorry, you know, sorry for the inconvenience," but they would not say, "We are so sorry." So I try to be attuned to that and to be true to that, you know, depending on the character's background.
For each of you, do your characters ever take you places you didn't think they would take you, and what do you do when that happens, if indeed it does?
Indeed, and they do take me places I hadn't anticipated, and that's the good news. That's when you know that something is alive in what you're thinking. You know, it's the luxury is to go back and sort of shape it. When I get concerned is when my characters do exactly what I thought they would do from the very start.
Salman Rushdie was asked a question like this last night and gave a great answer. Yeah. And he said something very similar, that, you know, he said, "Well, obviously I'm writing the character and I'm in control, but the fact is, once they've become multidimensional, they do things that, you know, you realize this person would do this, and even though I want him to do this other thing." And it's really interesting. I mean, I've had that happen myself. And, you know, for me, an example was in my first novel where I sensed something happening between a male and female character, and I thought, I don't want this to be a romance because for various reasons. And by the end, I had to follow that storyline. So.
Yeah, I've had similar experiences. I have sort of a funny, for me at least, anecdote about when I was doing the first draft for this novel, because there's a the third other central character in the book is an 11-year-old girl whose parents are killed in this restaurant shooting. And I had forgotten that she was, that I knew that her parents had a child, but I had forgotten when I was working on the novel about their kid until they were killed. And then I thought, oh, wait a second, I have a story that is sitting there that I haven't thought of exploring. I haven't thought about this character. And she ends up narrating much of the second half of the book, actually. She's not a character I had anticipated even trying to inhabit. African-American girl who grows up initially in Jamaica Plain and then moves up to Watertown. And I just found that was so exciting and kind of a thrilling experience. I do talk to writers sometimes who map everything out and do these outlines. I do outlines, but I'm always throwing them away and starting over. And I just find that to be such a... that to me is what makes it fun to work on something. Hearing the characters talk, as I mentioned earlier, and then seeing what the things they end up doing. So. Mm-hmm.
Yes. So the question is about alternate endings?
I'm very structured in that I always need to have, with a short story or a longer piece, I always need to have a working title and I always need to know the final scene. Mm-hmm. And so that is, to me, really important. At least to know what I'm writing toward. And it might change. It might not be the final scene. I might throw it out. But I always tell myself that I know where I'm going because I might otherwise, you know, I wander in other ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great question. And with stories, I never really knew. I was just kind of going forward and seeing where I would end up. And I think with the novel, it's very helpful to have an idea of where you're going to end. But I notice, I mean, I've only written two now, but in both cases, I sort of knew where I was going to end. But the question was, you know, one case I knew there was a betrayal, but I didn't know to what degree, or was this a real betrayal or an assumed one? And I notice I'm working on a novel now, and you really made me think of this. I've already written the final scene, but I don't know if it happened or if it's imaginary. So it's interesting, and I'll find out, but probably in like 2 years.
I'm pretty much in agreement with my friends here. I don't write stories, or I don't write decent stories. I tend to think discursively when I'm writing fiction, so I end up always writing to length. And I need to have, I don't even quite know how to describe it. It's not abstract, that's not the idea. But I need to have some vague sense of a destination. But in concrete terms, with characters who I imagine are going to, in essence, do what I assume they'll do. But as Daphne and Doug have both said, you have to remain flexible about it and sort of follow them after a while. I don't mean to suggest that I just sort of wait for the muse, that I just kind of tell what my characters tell me what I'm doing. But without a kind of a loose prescription of where they're going at the end. I don't think I could get there.
Well, I know.
For Doug, Trevor, I read your book, but I hadn't noticed maybe this one thing that you just read that I really liked. Walt has very low expectations for himself and his life,
yeah,
and because of his upbringing and his
right.
life. And the scene in the restaurant where he doesn't want to order something too wonderful,
yeah,
because he may never come back. So here's a way where you used a very concrete detail experience, and without hitting the reader over the head with it, you told us something very specific about Walt's personality. And it's really a question for anybody on the panel, but is that something you feel like you were conscious about when you were writing that? And how is that something that you kind of think about in your writing, how you might use something very specific, concrete like that to reveal something about your character?
Yeah, thank you for that observation and question. I mean, for me, I think about it all the time. I think about it particularly in third person. And one of the things I really had to work on in writing Girls I Know was to accept the fact that when you use the third person narration, you actually have that character, that third person voice that is a character. And that character needs to be developed. And I wanted that, even though much of the contents of my novel are quite dark, I wanted that voice to be a lively voice. I wanted that sensibility to notice things, but in a manner that could be somewhat humorous, because otherwise I thought for myself writing the book, I wouldn't be able to write the book if I didn't feel like there were portals or places where I could have fun, or where the tone of observation was would be slightly ironic and slightly detached. So I think the point of view really impacts on that and that kind of choice. And one of the things that's tricky that the other Doug was mentioning here with regards to voice is that the tricky thing I think about not knowing where you're going, especially if you use first person, then you get a voice that just goes on and on and on. So I the original, an early chapter of this novel publishes a story, and it was in the first person. It was in Walt's point of view. And when I tried to move it into a novel, I thought, oh, this guy, I got it. There's just, it's too leaden in quality in a way. And so how do I lighten this up? And so the minute I moved out of his head, it went much better for me.
When Daphne used the socks, which I actually remembered the socks more than I remembered the ex-wife being there. Because I just thought that was so funny and her reaction to it.
Yeah, the way we reason through things and what we focus on is
because without the socks, we would have a scene. Yeah. And Doug, I mean, you're having to choose in memoir genre, you're having to choose ones, details that represent you.
Yes, exactly. I've never written personal nonfiction before until this book. And the great dilemma for me was how to step forward as a character, even though it was a nonfictional character myself at various stages of my life, and to make that sort of revealing without making it indulgent. And I had a wonderful piece of advice from a friend of mine, a wonderful essayist, Philip Lopate, who had read the material, and he said, what you have now in some of these early essays is the narrator is a consciousness. And you need for the character to be not a consciousness, but a character. And, you know, in other words, as I understood Philip, you need to concretize it. You need to personalize it. You need to make this narrator dimensional. And I've written fiction from the first person point of view, but it's not the same issue at all. I mean, that is an invented character, and I can feel free to indulge him, as it turned out in this case. But when it's myself, and when you're talking about things that happen truly, it's a harder barrier to break for me. Was a harder barrier to break.
Yes. So the question is, how do you decide what to cut?
I spend a lot of time cutting, which is, in fact, people often say, do you work by word count? And I say no, because often, even while I'm adding material, I'm cutting. So it would seem like I was never doing any work at the end of the day. I would have no word count. I am very strict about, you know, if something, you can have a great scene, but if it's not moving the story forward, revealing something new about character or plot, I cut it. And I cut many scenes. You know, from the book I just read, for instance, I had a whole scene that I spent so long on showing that character we never met, Remy, when she was in school with a guy on the corridor of her dorm who had a crush on her and listening to music together and trying to reveal something. That ended up being one sentence because I realized at a certain point it's wrong to bring the reader's focus in to this level on something that's not going to be significant to the greater story that can be summarized. So that's my rule.
Isn't Elmore Leonard who said that you should cut the paragraphs that you would skip as a reader? You know, that sense where you turn the page and you have a block of prose and no breaks at all. I don't have the attention span to handle that. So I try to think, I cut a lot in terms of pacing. I think along the lines of what Daphne was saying, I think about pacing. But I also reminded of something that a mentor told me a long time ago, which was that you're not writing a poem to yourself. So it's not about you. It's not about your interests. So I had a very long chunk of this novel that was set in Mattapan that was hard for me to research, and I felt very close to, and it required me to. I needed to get help with Spanish, and I was going to Mattapan, and I just felt like I'm doing this research. So, and it didn't work at all. I took the whole thing out, and when I pulled it out, it created a kind of hole in the narrative. And holes are good. I think the idea that in our lives are filled with holes, of things we don't understand and things we circle around that we don't really want to think about or address entirely or directly. And I think that should be welcomed in writing.
I would just add, or not add, but sort of in my own way, agree that someone said to me, you know, it has to be interesting to someone besides your mother. I think it's a good rule.
We had a question in the back. Do you still?
Yeah, I was wondering what's the most effective way that you develop characters?
What's the most effective way you develop characters?
You guys were talking about plot driven somewhat.
I wanted to go back to that. I was thinking about the question about words and characters talking. I really think I start on the outside. I've been working on a story that I just finished, and at one point there's these two brothers, and they're in their 50s, and their lives are totally in shambles. And at one point, one of the brothers calls the other brother a dipwad, and I was like, that word, I've never used dipwad, and I was so excited about that word. And Ginger, so I thought, I want to think about what a 55-year-old guy who repairs roofs and who uses the word dipwad, like, what is that guy like? And the same with Ginger when she calls people losers. And so I think that's hearing the way a character talks, I think, is sometimes a little bit more organizing than thinking about what is the person's worldview or what do they think about Heidegger or something. It seems like such a massive, hard to be on the inside sometimes.
I mean, another great way to define your character is to put them up against something. It doesn't have to be major. It could be something very small in the scene. But that character is going to react the way only that character would react. And it's a way to show in action, I think, who discover who that character is. I tend to be really internal and be thinking about their observations about the world. But then you can end up just having a scene that's in someone's head, which is not very interesting sometimes to read. So, but I love reading books where it's the dialogue or even just a sentence or a word that defines who this character is.
It's a great question, and it's a completely mysterious aspect of writing fiction particularly. And I was just thinking of my novels as the others were answering. In each case, the central characters, or the central character, came from different places. In the first novel, it was sort of a character who emerged out of my living in an environment that was very strange and alien to me, and I just became a kind of anthropologist in a way. And the character kind of, you know, crystallized. Another novel was based on someone who actually lived, and I had great fun taking that as the root and then fictionalizing it. And another novel was the first person talking, and that had somewhat of an autobiographical cast to it, but nothing that happened to my character ever happened to me. But there were familiar antecedents. So in each case, it's come from a very different place. But I think for me, I always start with character. Whatever the story ultimately becomes, if I have a concept as opposed to a character, I'm in big trouble.
Yes.
That was yes. Well,
ontology.
So Ginger is interested in scholastic philosophy, and so Girls I Know is her attempt to write a scholastic theodicy. Theodicy is a book that defends the omnipotence and the benevolence of God in spite of the existence of evil. So Ginger thinks it's too trendy to read writers that anyone else has heard of, as you might expect from your little sample of her. So she starts to read Peter Lombard and Aquinas and all these scholastics, and in an attempt to write this book, Girls I Know, that she claims early in the novel would be the kind of book that Thomas Aquinas would have written if he had been a women's studies major. So that's where it came in, and I mean, that's where, I'll leave it at that.
One more question? Yeah. Do editors exist anymore?
Editors as rumor. Yes, editors do exist. But in terms of before you get to an editor, I think over time you develop your own editor, you become your own editor to a great degree. But it's also your great fortune if you have a small or even a somewhat larger circle of trusted readers. I have three friends who read everything at some point when I'm writing it. So they're my kind of collective editor.
I too have a trusted posse of friends who see my work at various stages, and my editor will not see that until it is done. And that doesn't mean she won't give feedback, but I know from experience it will be very broad and not terribly precise. Some vague questions about a few things. So I need it to be, I definitely rely on my friends.
I had a great experience with my editors who are actually here, Michelle and Andrew, who worked with me on Girls I Know. I do though accept the somewhat skeptical premise of the question, because I do think in the world of literary and short story world, it's very rare in my experience to have an editor come back and say, this story needs some work, but we'll take it, just refine it. I've had that happen much less. That happens to me much less rarely than it did years ago. So I think there's less editing going on in that domain, but I do still think they're editors and that we need editors. And we also need, I have a close group of friends who are writers, a couple of close friends who read my work, but it's the editor and the reader as the concepts are such wonderful concepts. The idea of the invested but the slightly disinterested party who reads not thinking about what he or she is writing, but really about the sentences. And I hope we don't lose those entities.
Great. Okay, the authors will be signing books right back there. So if you have any further questions for them, you can head back there and talk to them and buy their books. And then we have an historical fiction panel here at 2:00. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Thanks, Michelle.